This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Co-op Radio at CFRO 102.7 FM.
Once upon a time in the land of children's books, there were revolutionary chickens. A small chick who cried, "Strike down the wall," and liberated itself from the egg state. A flock of chickens who drove out the barnyard aristocracy and created a community in which each member gets a fair share of the food. A socially conscious hen who stopped traffic, questioned the law, and refused to be stopped from feeding the hungry children. These chickens are part of a cast of characters featured in the new book, Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature. Together with introductory essays, the anthology is a collection of 43 stories, illustrations, poems, and primers that embody the ideals of radical politics in the 20th century. They address issues like labor and civil rights, gender equality, peace, and environmental responsibility. Julia L. Mickenberg is Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's the co-editor of this collection. She joins us from Austin this morning. Hello, Julia.
Hi.
Now, in the foreword to the book, Jack Zipes maintains that all children's literature is political. What does he mean by that?
Well, all children's literature is trying to communicate some kind of message to the younger generation. And even children's books that portray the world as it is, as the way, as that's how it should be, that's a political message. That's arguably a very conservative message if it says that everything in the status quo is just fine. And so it's really impossible to talk about many ideas without talking about politics. And I think especially when you're talking to children, there are often these kinds of implicit judgments about how one should be, how people should be in the world.
So what kind of ethics or values have you found expressed, for instance, in people coming from a conservative perspective in terms of children's literature?
Well, stories like, there have been a number of books published in the last few years, like Lynn Cheney's Patriotic Primer or Bill O'Reilly's O'Reilly Factor for Kids. And I have to confess, I don't spend a lot of time reading these books, but books that are often, both the right and the left have often used American history or history in general, and books that are conservative tend to glorify the history of those in power and sort of show that, I'm more familiar with American literature and this literature would show, American wars as the United States always having been in the right, lawmakers having been in the right, basically glorifying those who are holding power. And that, that by nature is what conservatism is about. It's saying that the way things are is the way that they should stay.
And what was the criteria for inclusion in your book?
Well, in this book we had sort of a few criteria of inclusion. We wanted to represent the range of radical movements in the United States in the 20th century. We stuck to the United States and the 20th century basically to create some kind of continuity and also have some historical relevance. We wanted to include stories that would be historically relevant but also be fun to read and fun to listen to. We focused on works that were out of print, and that way we could better afford to include the works that were in there, and then we could sort of justify this as an act of recovery. Almost all of these stories are pieces that would be very difficult to find. You might be able to find them in used bookstores or in libraries, but you can't buy almost any of these books new. There's one exception in the book. So we wanted to represent the range of radical movements in the 20th century, ranging from socialism to communism to labor movement to the New Left, the Civil Rights Movement, feminist movement, and we have examples that speak to each of those. If you trace the history of these radical movements, you can see that each of them had schools and programs for children and also children's literature. So going back before the 20th century, abolitionists had a magazine for children called The Slave's Friend. Socialists had socialist Sunday schools. They had the Little Socialist magazine for boys and girls, and they had stories such as things we've included, like examples, excerpts from the Socialist Primer, the Child Socialist Reader, Nature Talks on Economics, which you actually referred to in your introduction. Communists had a children's organization called the Young Pioneers, and the Communist Party publisher, International Publishers, had a juvenile section called Young World Books. We have examples of communist literature, like a piece from Fairy Tales for Workers' Children. There's a story called Why, a boy keeps asking why people are hungry, why they're poor, why the poor get nothing and the rich keep getting more. You also referred to the example of the rebelling chickens in Battle in the Barnyard. Several labor unions published stories. We've included the story Mary Stays After School. That was published by the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, and it's about a little girl, sort of a fairy tale, little girl learning to be proud of her union-leading father. SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, first published Julius Lester's Black Folk Tales. We've included an example of one of those. Second Wave Feminists had their own press, the Lollipop Power Press. Ms. Magazine had a Stories for Free Children section, and we have some examples from there, such as X, A Fabulous Child Story. That's about a baby who grows up gender-free and is proud of it. And then there were also things written by people who weren't actively affiliated with these movements, but were obviously influenced by the concerns, whether it was fighting racial discrimination or fighting for workers' rights and, you know, other fighting for peace, et cetera.
I'm very interested in the idea of fairy tales, because that's something that we often associate with children. How have radicals adapted the fairy tale form to counter the myths of, you know, something like Cinderella and Prince Charming and the like?
Sure. I mean, Jack Zients, who did the foreword to the book, is kind of the world expert on radical fairy tales. In Germany, there was which has, you know, very old fairy tale traditions. During the Weimar period, there were many examples of people who were rewriting fairy tales, which tend to support patriarchy and power having new forms. So Herminia Zermulin, who wrote the Fairy Tales for Workers' Children, was probably the most active in Germany. Jay Williams wrote a number of feminist fairy tales in the 60s and 70s, and we've included his The Practical Princess, and that's a story about a practical princess who slays a dragon and then rescues a sleeping prince. We also have The Princess Who Stood on Her Own Two Feet, which was from Stories for Free Children, which was a book that grew out of Ms. Magazine, and that's a princess who is ashamed of being tall, and this prince seems to not like her because she's too tall and because she talks too much, and she starts sitting down and trying to not speak and all these things, and then realizes that that who she is more important. Being who she is more important than having this stupid prince like her. And there are lots and lots of examples, which I think play on the fact that children really like this form and are drawn into it. And it also plays on the familiarity and expectations that children already have with the genre, and kind of flips the messages. So, in fact, I did a little reading from The Practical Princess, and a little girl in the audience raised her hand and she said, "That's just like Sleeping Beauty." Well, yes, it is, but the sleeping person is a prince.
Nice. Now, a guiding principle of many progressive movements has been the importance of organizing and collective action. Many of the authors that you've got in your collection reflect this principle in their writing, but one of them might surprise readers. Can you tell us a bit about Sid Hoff and his story, Mr. His?
Well, sure. I mean, Sid Hoff is a very well-known children's author, maybe not as well-known today, but his books are definitely still in print. He wrote Danny and the Dinosaur and Sammy and the Seal. He was also known for his New Yorker cartoons. In the 1930s, he had an alternative identity as A. Redfield, and he was an art editor for... I think he was an art editor for the New Pioneer, which was a communist children's magazine, and he also wrote for the New Masses. His story, Mr. His, A Children's Story for Anybody, was published in 1939 in the New Masses originally, and then it was made into a book, and that's about a fat man called Mr. His, who owns an entire town called His Town, and he goes happily through his days owning everything while all the workers in the town are suffering, and he couldn't care less. And then one day, of course, the workers get together and rebel and change the name of the town to Our Town, and then they're happy again. But in some ways it's a very kind of stereotypical story about workers rebelling, but it's very funny and it's wonderful artwork. So it's it's pretty different from Danny and the Dinosaur, but the artwork is very familiar if you know Sidhoff's work.
Hmm. I think that that children really respond to the idea of the villain as well.
Yeah.
Now,
I mean, in a sense, if you think about it, the story of the stories of the oppressed are appealing to children who often feel like they are disempowered and oppressed. In some sense, you know, they're always having to follow somebody else's rules, and they can identify with people who don't have control over their lives, because I think that's the way children often feel.
Yeah. In the book, you include a section on science and technology. What's the motivation for radical authors to write about science?
It's interesting. I mean, this was something, you know, my co-editor, Phil Nell, we kind of went back and forth on this. This was something that I felt very strongly that we include pieces about science in there. And the reason for that was in my first book, which was on children's literature and the left, it's called Children's Literature, the Cold War, and Radical Politics in the United States, I found that one of the main realms in which radicals were writing children's literature was science. In fact, it could be the area where there was the most work published. And this seemed kind of strange to me, as it might seem strange to you and to your listeners. So I started looking at this question, and I found a number of reasons. I think on a very basic level, there was this belief that if children could understand the way the world works, they could be empowered to change the world. There's also this notion that science teaches critical thinking. It teaches them to question received authority. And then I even talked to somebody who had worked at international publishers, who rather baldly said, well, if we teach children to think, you know, scientifically or dialectically, they can become... she said, if we teach children to think scientifically, they'll learn dialectical materialism and, you know, sort of become Marxists simply by studying science. So that was kind of an extreme reason there. But we have examples of stories that... one of my favorites in the book, and actually one of my daughter is so crazy about this story that she wants to have her whole birthday party be a performance of The Day They Parachuted Cats on Borneo, a drama of ecology. This was a story written by Charlotte Pomerantz and published in 1971. And it teaches the unintended consequences of DDT. It's based on a true story about the island of Borneo, in which DDT was used to kill mosquitoes, and this had a chain of unintended consequences where rats are eating the mosquitoes and getting infected, and cats are eating the rats, and all these things happen, and they actually had to drop cats down to control the rat population. And that's a story that takes a very serious problem and uses humor, if you can imagine having humor about it, but using that funny chain of events to inject humor and teach a lesson. It also has wonderful artwork. Another story that you mentioned right at the beginning was Nature Talks on Economics, and that was by Caroline Nelson, who was a socialist and an organizer for birth control. And this story is written in the nature study tradition, in which a father is talking to children and using things happening in nature to teach moral lessons, and in this case, to teach a kind of morality based on radical politics. And there's a scene where an egg is hatching, and the father says, look, the egg didn't just say, I've always been in an egg state, and I will stay in an egg state until I die, and he, put his head against the wall of capitalism until it crashed down. So it, uses that hatching of the egg as a metaphor for breaking out of the shell of capitalism. So, and there are numerous examples, many of them not explicit at all. We tried to include stories that had some kind of obvious politics. There was also many examples of using the authority of science to challenge racism, for example, was a very common thing, showing, you know, children of different races can have the same blood type, or that using anthropology, which is a kind of science, to show that racial groups who are different because of environment and not because of biology. So,
do you see it in the work that you've put together a kind of correlation between what's going on in the fight against discrimination and protection of minority rights and those threads being, you know, more or less documented in children's literature?
There was a real effort, you know, in my first book, I found that one of the key thrusts in the 1940s and 1950s was the fight against racism. So this was, which was really growing in the 1940s, 1950s, and 1960s, as you know. And this manifested sometimes in very simple and oblique ways. There was a book published in 1945 called Two as a Team, in which a black child and a white child were best friends. And the text said nothing about this. It just had the pictures. And that was very radical and unusual at that time to have a black child and a white child who were friends. Dorothy Sterling is an author who died recently. She wrote a book called Mary Jane, which had two children. Which is the story of a girl who was integrating a school, and that was, again, very political for its time. She had difficulty getting it published. A story that we include in here is Langston Hughes's first book. Well, an excerpt from Langston Hughes' first book of Negroes, which was published in 1952, while he was in the middle of being investigated by various committees, suffering from blacklisting. And so he was, in many ways, trying to tone down his politics at the time, but he was urged by his publishers, who were trying to show how liberal they were, to make clear the facts of discrimination. So this little story in there is about a boy named Terry who lives in New York City, and it talks about, well, if Terry lived in the South, he couldn't go to restaurants that white people eat in. He couldn't sit next to them in buses. He couldn't travel next to them on trains. So it's very explicit about that. And then it also says this kind of discrimination is legal, but blacks know that it's wrong and that it goes against the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. So it's fairly explicit about this being this happening and this being unjust. And you get a number of stories that are also, giving details about black history. We included stories from the radical black newspaper Freedom, which had portraits of Ida Wells and a number of other figures. Joe Molnar was a photographer who went out and did these books where he recorded stories and took photographs. He had one about a Mexican-American girl, about a Puerto Rican girl, a Chinese-American boy. So there were many efforts to just bring to life the stories of children who were not white, because up until the mid-1960s, if you look at children's literature, certainly published in the United States, you see almost nothing but white faces. It's quite striking. There was an article published in 1965 in Saturday Review, I think, called The All-White World of Children's Literature, which actually studied not even who was the protagonist, but just what color were the faces in the books. And it was 95% white. And there was a real effort beginning in the 1960s to change that. But prior to that, most of the efforts had been by radicals.
Julia, how do you see this book being used? How do you see this book sort of coming into the lives of adults and children?
You know, this was a complicated issue when we were putting the book together and figuring out who it would be for, because in many ways I see this as a book for a kind of educated museum going public, people who are interested in culture. But I'm finding that kids are really quite interested in the book. I have met a number of children who are, say, 10, 11, and 12, who are devouring the book, who are quite fascinated by it. I also see it as a book that progressive parents may want to share many of the stories with their children. I have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old, and the 5-year-old in particular loves, of course, I think she's proud that her mother helped put the book together, but she really likes a lot of the stories. So I can see parents reading them to their children, selecting, you know, because there's a lot in there that I think now is maybe not, is actually not appropriate for children. And then I can also see teachers, educators using this to if you're trying to teach about children's literature, this is a whole area of children's literature that's pretty unknown, and I think it's a history worthy of understanding.
Well, thank you very much for sharing so much about the book with us this morning, and I hope many of our listeners, and certainly I will be diving into it more deeply.
Great. Well, thanks so much for interviewing me.
I've been speaking with Julia L. Mickenberg. She's Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin, and she's the co-editor of Tales for Little Rebels, a collection of radical children's literature.